Welcome to the Deadcast.
May 26th, 1978, St. Joseph, Missouri. 4-year-old Eric Christensen disappears from the downtown area. A search is organized as people frantically look for the young child. When his body is found lying next to the Missouri River, suffocated and obviously sexually assaulted, the community is horrified. The police go into overdrive, questioning well over 100 people, as well as, quote-unquote, every known pervert in the area. Eventually, they settle on a 25-year-old man by the name of Melvin Reynolds, who is known to have low intelligence, as well as to have been abused himself as a child, which in turn led to him having what was called at the time homosexual episodes in his youth. The police question Reynolds on numerous occasions, administering 2 polygraph tests, placing him under hypnosis, before finally, in December of 1978, they questioned him under sodium amytal, which at the time was known as a truth serum. Reynolds reportedly made ambiguous marks while underneath the drug that heightened the police's suspicions of him. Eventually, in February of 1979, Reynolds was interrogated for over 14 hours. Eventually, the exasperated man blurted out, "I'll say so if you want me to," before confessing to the crime. In the following weeks, Reynolds embellished on his confession, offering details that were fed to him by police. Eventually, he was sentenced to life in prison, although he would not spend the rest of his days there. For another man, an unknown petty criminal by the name of Charles Ray Hatcher would step from the shadows and clear Reynolds' name while he admitted his own horrific crimes. Hello again and welcome to the Deathcast. I am your host, best-selling independent author Ian Tott, and I'd like to thank you for joining me today as we take a look at the life and crimes of serial killer Charles Ray Hatcher. Before we dive into the case, as always, I have my normal plugs. If you'd like to follow me on social media, you can find me on Twitter at AuthorTotten. You can also find me on Instagram and Facebook at Ian Totten Author. On the Facebook page, there is a tab for groups, and there is a Deathcast group that's associated with that page. If you'd like to help support the show, there's a couple ways you can do that. The first is to leave a 5-star review wherever you find your podcasts. They really do help. I'm also on Patreon under Ian Totten Author. That's one of the ways that you can financially help to support this show. I'm currently working on adding new tiers through that page. You can also find me on PayPal and Venmo if you'd like to make a one-time donation and help with the production of the show. You can find me there at Ian Totten. If you're interested in my books, of which there are currently 5, you can find those on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, pretty much any place you can find books. Just type Ian Totten, that's T-O-T-T-E-N, into the search bar, and they will come up. I also have one of my books on Audible, and another one, the most current, The Throwaway Girls of Olympia, which is soon to be coming out on audiobook. Alright, now that the plugs are out of the way, get yourself something to drink, sit back in a chair, relax. If it's snowing outside, I hope you're home safe. I've got my coffee, I've got my cigarettes. Let's go into the crypt. Okay, as you heard in the trailer, this week we're going to be discussing serial killer Charles Ray Hatcher. Now, Hatcher is a rather forgotten serial killer. I won't say I'm an expert on serial killers, but I know a heck of a lot about them. I've been reading about them and case studies on them and everything for, God, close to 20 years at this point. He's one of those ones I had never heard of up until about a month ago when I was doing some research for another episode and his name popped up. And you know how that goes when you're online and you click on somebody's name and the next thing you know, you're down a rabbit hole. Charles Ray Hatcher was born July 16, 1929, in Mound City, Missouri, which is a small town that's 34 miles north of St. Joseph. He was the youngest child of Jesse and Lula Hatcher's four children. Hatcher's father was an ex-convict as well as an abusive alcoholic, and he would take out his frustrations and rages on his wife and children. Hatcher was picked on at school, and he eventually became something of a bully, and classmates said that he seemed to derive a sick pleasure in torturing and inflicting pain upon them. And I have to believe that some of that stems from the abuse that he was receiving at home from his father. Hatcher's life took a sharp turn in the spring of 1935. He and his older brothers were out flying a kite that they had constructed using copper wire that they had found in an old Model T Ford. His oldest brother, Arthur Allen Hatcher, was about to hand the kite to Charles when it hit a high-voltage power line and electrocuted him. Arthur was pronounced dead at the scene. This is one of those things, coupled with the abuse that he was receiving at home, as well as the bullying that was going on at school, that, you know, gives rise to the idea of nature versus nurture. You know, are serial killers born that way, or are they created? I personally believe that they are born that way, but cases like Hatcher's do give, you know, rise to the idea that some of them might not be born that way, and that the traumas that they experienced in childhood turn them towards that. You know, they say that, you know, the first few years of life for a child are the most important, and as we can see with Charles Ray Hatcher, the first few years of his life are extremely tumultuous and violence-filled. The death of Arthur Hatcher had serious consequences on the rest of the family. Charles Ray's father left the family shortly after this event took place, and he eventually divorced Hatcher's mother. Hatcher's mother would go on to marry after her husband left. That marriage, too, ended in a divorce. And she eventually married again for a third time. And it was this third marriage that took Hatcher from his familiar surroundings. When the family moved in 1945 to St. Joseph, Missouri. Now, this is when Hatcher was 16. In 1947, when he was 18, he got his first job setting pins at a bowling alley. And it doesn't look like he was at that job very long, because by the fall of 1947, he had gotten himself a job driving truck and hauling for the Iowa Missouri Walnut Company. And now this job only lasted about 2 weeks. On October 9th, 1947, the company reported that one of their trucks had been stolen, and Hatcher returned it the next morning. He was reportedly intoxicated at the time and admitted to stealing the truck. This was Hatcher's first known criminal conviction, and he was given a 2-year suspended sentence. This was the start of a very long career as a petty criminal. On February 5th, 1948, still age 18, Hatcher got another job, this time at the St. Francis Hotel in St. Joseph. He was washing dishes and basically doing other odd jobs. Hatcher ended up being convicted for auto theft a second time, this time for stealing a 1937 Buick, and he ended up catching 2 years in the Missouri State Penitentiary. And shows you how fast this all happened. He gets the job at the hotel on the 5th. By the 7th of February, he's reporting to prison for the first time. Now, not much is known about his first stint in prison. What I was able to find is that he was released from prison on June 8th, 1949, after serving a little less than 3/4 of his sentence. He wouldn't be out long, however, because on the 10th of October 1949, he was convicted of forgery for a $10 check at a gas station in Maryville, Missouri. He ended up catching 3 years for this particular crime. Now, Hatcher spent the next few years in prison until March 18th, 1951, where he escaped from the Missouri State Penitentiary. He was eventually caught again and received an extra 2 years on his sentence. Upon being released from prison on July 14th, 1954, Hatcher stole a 1951 Ford in Orrick, Missouri, and he was again sentenced to prison, this time getting 4 years. He attempted to escape from the jailhouse in Ray County before his sentencing, and he got 2 more years on top of this, leading him to be in prison until March 18th, 1959. And it was at this point that Hatcher's criminal career began taking a darker turn. On June 26, 1959, he attempted to abduct a 16-year-old boy from St. Joseph, Missouri. This is a newspaper boy named Stephen Pelham, and he did so while threatening the boy with a butcher knife. Pelham took off and reported the crime to the police, and when Hatcher was eventually arrested, they found him driving another stolen vehicle. He ended up being sentenced to 5 years in the Missouri State Penitentiary for the attempted abduction as well as the auto theft. This was done under the Habitual Criminal Act. And all the reports that I could find stated that while Hatcher was waiting to be transported to prison, he attempted to break out of the Buchanan County Jail, which was unsuccessful. And now, one report that I found stated that upon arriving back at the Missouri State Penitentiary, Hatcher claimed to be the most notorious criminal in Northwest Missouri since Jesse James. So it should give you something of an idea as to Hatcher's mentality at this point in his life, that he's comparing himself to, you know, a legendary Old West outlaw. Now, 1961 is when Hatcher's crime spree took an extremely dark turn. Prior to this, with the exception of the attempted abduction, Hatcher had mainly stuck to, you know, house burglaries, forged checks, stealing cars. On July 2nd, 1961, when Hatcher was 31 years old, that all changed. Jerry Therrington, who was another inmate at the Missouri State Penitentiary, was found raped and stabbed on the prison's loading dock. Hatcher was the only convict who was not on scene when the body was found, and because of this, the prison officials immediately suspected that he was involved in the murder. Now, unfortunately, they could not find enough evidence to convict Hatcher of the murder, so instead they sent him to solitary confinement, stating later that that was the only punishment that was available to them at the time. And Hatcher would remain in solitary for a couple of years. In January of 1962, when he was 32 years old, he sent a note to the prison officials claiming that he understood that he needed psychiatric help. His request was turned down by the prison psychologist, who felt that it was nothing more than a ploy to get out of solitary confinement and possibly get out of prison early. I've read a couple of different things that people feel that had Hatcher gotten the help he needed at this time, he may have gone down an entirely different path in his life. Based on the fact that he had already committed one known murder at this point, however, and that he was predisposed to committing crimes, my personal opinion is that whether he had gotten help or not, it is doubtful that Hatcher would have stopped his killing. We've seen this in a number of other cases with serial killers who, although they do get help for their psychological issues, continue to murder, and in fact a lot of them escalate their crimes after receiving the treatment, and I think Hatcher is in that category. I don't believe he would have refrained from killing whether he had gotten psychiatric treatment or not, unless he was placed in, you know, a permanent facility for the remainder of his life, such as they did with Ed Gein. However, what did happen was Hatcher was eventually released from solitary confinement and returned to the general population. His sentence was also reduced to 3/4 of the original sentence, so basically 3.5 years out of 5. Now, in August of 1963, when Hatcher was 34 years old, he was released from prison. And his whereabouts over the next few years are kind of hard to pin down. He eventually ended up going to California, where he changed his name to Albert Ralph Price. And here is the odd thing. All the records that I was able to find have Hatcher confessing to abducting a boy in Aniak, California, which is in the Bay Area. Now, apparently the boy was riding down the street on his bicycle, and he was carrying a tennis racket with him when Hatcher approached him and told the boy to get in the car and they would go for a ride. Hatcher, according to this story, drove to a creek and strangled the boy with his hands. And the reason I say this is somewhat hard to believe is that Hatcher was apparently let go by the police after the murder of this child whose name was William Freeman. Because on August 29th, 1969, a 6-year-old Mexican child named Gilbert Martinez was reported missing in the San Francisco area. There was a witness to the abduction. It was another 6-year-old, a girl who Martinez had been playing with. And the girl stated that Martinez had walked away with a man who had offered him ice cream. and he was found by a man walking his dog as the boy was being beaten and sexually assaulted. And this is what I mean when I say, you know, something about this story is just kind of off to me. Why would you allow someone who just admitted to sexually assaulting and murdering a child to go right back out on the streets so that he could try and do it again? Now, this person who was walking the dog alerted the police to what he had come upon, and when the police arrived, they arrested the man who was going under the name of Albert Price. Though they found another set of identification on his person under the name of Hobart Prater. The police were naturally suspicious of the man, and they sent his fingerprints into the FBI and later learned that it was in fact Charles Ray Hatcher. In the meantime, however, Hatcher was still known under the name of Albert Price, and he was charged with assault, with attempt to commit sodomy and kidnapping, and the judge ordered him to undergo competency evaluations to determine his level of competency in order to stand trial. And a complete psychological evaluation was ordered. When Hatcher was found to be unresponsive during the preliminary evaluations, according to the records, Hatcher claimed to hear voices, and apparently he faked delusions as well as suicide attempts while in custody. And Hatcher ended up doing 5 tours at the California State Hospital. He was repeatedly sent back and forth between prison and the hospital, where he would be given various diagnoses, including being labeled a passive-aggressive personality with sexual deviation and pedophilia. According to the staff at the California State Hospital, they felt that Hatcher was malingering and was playing the system in order to avoid going back to prison. And they found he was competent enough to stand trial. However, another psychiatrist came in and said that they felt Hatcher was insane and needed to go under a vigorous regime of treatment inside of a secure hospital. A second psychiatrist who referred to Hatcher as Mr. Prince concluded that he was incompetent to stand trial and sent him back to the hospital. Now, that was in January of 1971. On May 24th of the same year, he finally got to trial, where Hatcher, still going under the name of Albert Prince, pleaded not guilty by reason of insanity. He was sent for evaluation again, and it was found that he was incompetent to stand trial. 2 days later, on May 27th of 1971, another examination took place with a Dr. Carl Drake Jr. Hatcher lied about his life history to the doctor, which is what resulted in another incompetency diagnosis. And you can see this quite a bit going back throughout the years with psychiatrists, that they rely exclusively on the words of the offenders in order to get their life history as well as come to a diagnosis regarding them. A few weeks later, on June 2nd, Hatcher escaped from the hospital, and he was caught a week later, 90 miles away in Colusa, California. When he was arrested, Hatcher was suspected of auto theft, and he was going under the name of Richard Lee Grady. And it wasn't until Hatcher was sent back to the hospital for another evaluation that staff recognized him and alerted to authorities who he actually was. In April of 1972, it was decided that Hatcher's treatment was going nowhere, and he was endangering other patients as well as staff, and he was transferred to the state prison hospital in Vacaville. In August of that year, he was sent to San Quentin Prison to stand trial. This was 3 years after his initial arrest, and two further evaluations were ordered, and both of them found him to be competent to stand trial. In December of 1972, he was tried and convicted for the abduction and molestation of Martinez, and by January, he was committed to the California State Hospital as a mentally disordered sexual offender. On March 28, 1973, security guards found Hatcher hiding in a cooler near the hospital's main courtyard with two sheets stuffed into his pants, and he eventually admitted that he was attempting to escape. Hatcher ended up going back to court, and doctors determined that he was still a threat to society. In April of 1973, he was sentenced to 1 year to life and sent to a medium security prison in Vacaville. In May of 1973, a psychologist termed Hatcher as a manipulative, institutionalized sociopath. In June, he attempted suicide by slashing his wrists when it was recommended that he be transferred to a maximum security prison. And because of this suicide attempt, Hatcher was diagnosed with paranoid schizophrenia, and he remained at Vacaville. So, there's nothing much to report for a few years until August of 1975, when guards stated that Hatcher was a model prisoner during a parole board review. These guards also stated that Hatcher performed his duties in the hospital's kitchen exceedingly well. In June of 1976, it was determined by the parole board that he had improved considerably during his time in prison, and they seriously began to discuss paroling Hatcher, with a projected release date of December 25th, 1978. On January 3rd of 1977, they gave Hatcher a modified parole date and decided to release him 19 months earlier than expected. They did this because a bill had passed that would give credit to inmates for time spent not only in jails but in mental health facilities as well. On May 20th, 1977, Hatcher was released to a halfway house in San Francisco. At this point, he's 47 years old. Hatcher was supposed to report back to this halfway house every night at 9 p.m., at which point he would be given a number of prescription pills. However, on May 25th, this is just 5 days after his release, Hatcher vanished, and he was listed in the records for this halfway house as a walkaway. By June 13th, 1977, he was declared a parolee at large, and unfortunately, they only had one sighting of him after this for almost a year, and that was in Wilmar, Minnesota. Beyond that, it seems Hatcher completely went off the grid. Now, at this point, it's where we initially came into our story, which was May 27th, 1978. That was when Eric Christian disappeared in downtown St. Joseph, Missouri. Which we discussed in the trailer, there was a false conviction regarding this case. As for Hatcher, he was arrested September 4th of 1978 in Omaha, Nebraska for a sexual attack on a 16-year-old boy. And somehow Hatcher was able to get out of this because he was arrested numerous times between the fall of 1978 and the spring of 1982. These include molesting a teenage boy, attempting to stab a 7-year-old boy, fighting over payment for a sex act with a young man. All of these took place in Omaha, Nebraska. And in nearby Lincoln, Nebraska, he molested a man as well as attempted to stab another man in Des Moines, Iowa. He also abducted an 11-year-old boy from a shopping mall in Bendorf, Iowa. Now, unfortunately, I don't have a timeline for when those specific crimes all took place. I do have that on January 31st in 1979, at age 49, he was released from the Douglas County Mental Hospital in Omaha, where he had been for the sexual attack, which took place in September of 1978. That's the 16-year-old boy. And one thing interesting to note from all of this is that he had been running under the name of Richard Clark, as well as the fact that none of the places Hatcher was arrested while he was on the run bothered to run his fingerprints. Otherwise, it's highly likely that he would have gotten a red flag and they would have been able to stop him sooner. Now, on May 3rd of 1979, he was arrested again in Omaha for assault and attempting to kill a 7-year-old boy. These charges were eventually dropped and Hatcher was sent to a mental hospital. He eventually got released at the age of 50, only to come back to the mental health hospital 2 months later for another assault. On September 6, 1980, Hatcher escaped from the Norfolk Regional Health Center, and his whereabouts are unknown for about a month when he was arrested in Lincoln, Nebraska, under the name of Richard Clark, for the attempted assault and sodomy of a 17-year-old male. Hatcher was discharged from the hospital after 21 days. January 13th of 1981, Hatcher was arrested again under the name of Richard Clark, this time in Des Moines, Iowa, after he got into a knife fight. Hatcher spent time in various mental health facilities after this knife fight, up until April 10th of 1981, when he was discharged to a Salvation Army shelter in Davenport, Iowa. On June 20th, 1981, James L. Churchill, age 34, was found stabbed to death on the banks of the Mississippi River near Rock Island, Illinois. He had been stabbed between 10 to 12 times. Eventually, Hatcher would admit to murdering this man. He said that they had been hanging out drinking together, and some point during the evening, he was overcome with the urge to kill. He further went on to elaborate that he stabbed the man until the knife became embedded in the bone to the right of his chest near the heart. On July 16, 1981, Hatcher was arrested in Bettendorf, Iowa for attempting to abduct an 11-year-old boy at a grocery store. The boy was able to run to the police, who eventually arrested Hatcher, who was again going under the name of Richard Clark. The charges for this attempted abduction were dropped in March of 1982, although Hatcher was sent to a state hospital for a 49-day stay. In July of 1982, a woman was accosted by a man in a downtown shopping mall in St. Joseph, Missouri. According to the woman, he wanted to take her for a walk and buy her a cup of coffee. Later, the woman would identify her assailant as Hatcher. The next day, the 28th, Hatcher abducted a 10-year-old boy. The abduction took place outside of a mall in St. Joseph, Missouri. The boy had been browsing in a store at the mall when he was grabbed by the shoulder and told that he was a security guard. The boy got away from Hatcher and went to find his grandmother, whom he had been at the mall with. Although, before the police could arrive, Hatcher escaped. So it's kind of apparent that Hatcher's psychosis is spiraling out of control at this point, and it would reach its pinnacle the following day, July 29th, 1982. There was an abduction attempt reported in the St. Joseph Gazette, as well as an abduction that was unfortunately successfully carried out. Michelle Steele, who was an 11-year-old girl, was abducted and murdered. She was going to a dentist appointment in downtown St. Joseph. The appointment was at 10:30, and she left at roughly 11:30. This is Hatcher's only known female murder victim, and the girl was not reported as missing until her mother arrived home later that afternoon and found that the girl was not present. The next day, on the 30th of July, Michelle's uncle, Roy Montgomery, was searching when he noticed something sticking out from between two logs, and it turned out that it was, in fact, Michelle's body. It was found less than a mile downstream from where Eric Christian's body was found a few years earlier. That same day, Hatcher voluntarily checked himself into the St. Joseph State Hospital under the name of Richard Clark. He was claiming to hear voices. Something important to note in the regards to Michelle's case, beyond the fact that she was the only known female murder victim, she, like the others, had been beaten and raped severely, which makes me conclude that at the point that this murder had taken place, his paraphilia had gone completely off the deep end, and Hatcher was simply looking for any means to release his sexual and murderous desires. So much so that he went outside his already established norms of targeting young boys and went after a young girl. Now, while Hatcher was staying at the state hospital, police had begun to canvass the area looking for witnesses, and they got a number of witnesses who gave a description of the man who they had seen with a young girl that matched Hatcher's description. Because of this, on August 3rd, 1982, Hatcher was charged with first-degree murder for the murder of Michelle Steele, and his bond was set at $250,000. Along with the witnesses describing the man, they also were able to have Hatcher picked out of police lineups, as well as evidence that linked him directly to the crime. They found nylon cords which matched those that were found near the body. His teeth matched bite marks that had been found on Michelle, and his shoes also matched imprints in the soil near the body. Over the next few months, Hatcher played the same games he had while in California, claiming mental incompetency. And naturally, the courts ordered a number of different evaluations, all of which found him competent to stand trial. On May 3rd, 1983, at the age of 53, Hatcher, who was in the Buchanan County Jail, gave a scrap of paper to the deputy that was on duty. The note read, "Please call the FBI and tell them I would like to see them today. Very important case." When the FBI agent arrived, Hatcher gave the man a detailed map that directed him to the body of James Churchill. He also told the agent that there were 16 bodies in total, with 13 of them being adults, and that all of his victims had been male. One thing that came out of this interview, beyond the fact that Hatcher began to implicate himself in the death of Christian, was that he was willing to give up information on the murders in order to receive the death penalty. On May 28, 1983, Hatcher was charged under his real name. In the charging documents, it was noted that he had gone under a number of aliases, including Richard Martin Clark, Richard Harris, Richard Mark Clark, Richard Lee Grady, Richard Ree Price, Earl L. Kellebow, Albert Ayer, Charles Marvin Tidwell, Hobart Prater, Ronald Springer, Doris Mullins, Carl L. Kellebow, Albert Ralph Price, Doris Mullins Travis, and Dwayne Lee Wilfong. And I think this is kind of important to look at just for a moment, in that it proves that Hatcher was well aware of what he was doing, and that he, not as well as having all of these various aliases, he also had at least 6 social security numbers under which he operated. So it's obvious he knew exactly what he was doing during the span of his crimes. One interesting thing that I found, although I have only seen it in one reference, and that is on a Radford University website, is that Hatcher apparently had a diary concerning all of his murders, and that when police came to search his cell, apparently to look for this, he admitted to them that he had flushed it down the toilet. On July 25th of 1983, Hatcher wrote a detailed account about the murder of Christian. He sent this letter to the FBI, who, upon reading it, realized that it contained evidence that no one but the actual killer could know. On August 3rd of 1983, Hatcher confessed to the murder of James Churchill in 1981, as well as to the murder of William Freeman in California in 1969. He also gave evidence as to the murder of Eric Christian, and by the end of the interview, he had filled out a timeline for the police concerning his entire criminal career, from October 27, 1947 until his final arrest on July 29, 1982. On September 1st of 1983, a grand jury moved to charge Hatcher with capital murder in the murder of Michelle Steele. And on September 6th, he was officially indicted by a grand jury in the Buchanan County Courthouse for the murder. On September 12th, Hatcher pled not guilty, and a trial date was set for January 9th, 1984. However, while waiting on trial for the murder of Michelle Steele, he was sentenced to life in prison in the Missouri State Penitentiary for the murder of Eric Christians. Melvin Reynolds, who had initially been charged and convicted for the murder, was released the following day. On January 9th of 1984, Hatcher's attorney dropped him as a client, citing repeated abuse, and a new trial date was scheduled. Hatcher's trial started on September 17th, 1984, when he was aged 55. On September 22nd, 1984, he was convicted of capital murder in the case of Michelle Steele. It took the jury less than an hour to return a guilty verdict. And it was recommended that Hatcher be sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of probation or parole for 50 years. Hatcher met with the FBI agent he had initially talked to one final time in November of 1984. On December 3rd of that year, he appealed his conviction, asking for a new trial, which was denied. On December 7th, 1984, Hatcher hung himself in his cell at the Missouri State Prison,
using a piece of electrical wire that had been tied to the brace of a heavy metal ventilation grate in his cell. It was noted that Hatcher's hands had been tied behind his back with shoelaces, and officers on the scene attempted to revive him to no avail. On December 11th, a group of volunteers carried Hatcher's body to the prison cemetery, his family having refused to have anything to do with Hatcher. One thing I'd like to point out in regards to this is that a number of different sources went to great pains to point out the fact that Hatcher's brother disowned him upon his conviction and basically said they could throw his body in the garbage dump for all I care because that is all he is worth. Now, officially, Hatcher was convicted of two murders, although authorities suspect him of at least five. And as I said, he confessed to at least 16. So it's kind of hard to know whether or not he actually did these, specifically as he did not name all of his murder victims or tell where it had taken place or what he had done with the bodies. Something on a side note concerning Hatcher, I read a couple of different things, one on Wikipedia, a couple on a different sites, which I would see as more reputable than Wikipedia. Apparently, the makers of the Child's Play movies based the character of Chucky, whose name in the films is Charles Lee Ray, on Charles Ray Hatcher, going so far as to put the doll in a striped shirt similar to the shirts that Hatcher was seen to wear frequently. You'll see this when you go to the Instagram page when this episode comes out and I post pictures of Hatcher. Especially in his later years, he very closely resembles Jim Varney in Ernest Goes to Jail, specifically when he is playing the criminal version of Ernest. There is a very striking resemblance, so much so that I actually shared it with members of a true crime group I am a member of on Facebook called Murder, Mayhem, and Crime Horrors. And just really quick, I would like to thank the moderator of that group, who goes under the pseudonym of Nancy Drew, for allowing me to share the podcast on her page, as well as offering up stories for me to cover on the podcast. So, thank you to Murder, Mayhem, and Crime Horrors. If you are into true crime, and I'm not talking the kind of stuff you're going to see on, you know, the ID channel page that's on Facebook or on any of the Netflix true crime pages, but I mean honest to God true crime, you know, with pictures from crime scenes, I can't recommend that page enough, although I will give a little bit of a warning that if you have a weak stomach or are easily upset, you may want to avoid some of their posts. Alright, that is the Deathcast for this week. Again, I am your host, best-selling independent author Ian Totten. Only a couple more episodes to go before I call it for Season 1, at which point I will be taking a short break to work on a few pressing writing projects, as well as recharge and research some more cases to bring to you. So, until next week, stay safe and stay morbid.
the Deathcast.